WPPB is supported in part by Sotheby's International Realty, with offices in 40 countries globally and offices locally in the Hamptons in Southampton, Bridgehampton, East Hampton, and Sag Harbor. Our agents are local experts worldwide with a clear mission to pair exceptional properties with exceptional clients and offer them superior white glove service. For more information, email Sotheby's Associate Broker John Christopher at john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life. I'm John Christopher, your host, and today I have as my guest, Laura Grenning from the Grenning Gallery in Sag Harbor, New York. Hi, Laura. How are you?
Pretty good. Hi, John.
Good.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great today, especially now that you're here. You look very lovely.
Oh, thank you.
And it's always a pleasure to see you. You opened Grenning Gallery in Sag Harbor. I suspect you were an artist. Did you go to art school by any chance?
Your suspicions are incorrect.
Incorrect? You have an aesthetic.
I've always painted and drawn my whole life. And they tried to get me in high school to switch over to one of those special high schools dedicated to art.
But, we're talking about your parents then.
Yeah. No, the school. The school.
Oh, so you had a natural talent to begin with.
An interest too. I mean, I was really pretty passionate. But I had a lot of other interests. And I did a lot of sports in school. And I ended up staying in my regular high school. And then I went off to a liberal arts college thinking I would get art classes there. But my experience, I was a scholarship kid. So my time and the money I was spending was kind of valuable to me. And the art classes were, I would say, ultra light compared to economics and some of the science classes, which is what I was more interested in at the time.
So where did you grow up? I'm just curious.
I grew up in the suburbs of D.C. It was a little town called Rockville, Maryland. It had about 10,000 people when my family moved there. So it was like a little bit larger than Sag Harbor. It had a main street like that, and we had parades just like Sag Harbor. But it's almost – D.C. has grown up almost like Paris, and it's kind of sucked into D.C., and there's now about 200,000 people in my hometown.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if that's ever going to happen to Sag Harbor.
I don't think so.
We just have 200,000 people here.
I hope not. I don't mind for a couple months in the summer. It's good for business. I'll take it. I love it.
Right. That's fantastic. So what happened after college? Did you then get into art of some sort? What did you do?
Right out of college, I was just talking to a friend. I really enjoyed my education. I got a great education. And I don't know how, but I got a job in New York City before I left college.
Interviewed. So you knew exactly where you're going.
I wanted to go to New York, and I had a friend who was a painter in New York at college, and I told him I wanted to go represent his work and I wanted to be an art dealer. And that's what I wrote in my journals. However, I had a fairly hefty student loan bill, and I got offered a job, which I thought was an extraordinary amount of money.
At the time
it was actually. Right. And I was very impressed by the fact that after they offered me the job and I signed the contract, they put me in a car that had a phone in it and sent me to the airport. And I just felt like I had finally arrived. And that company, which I never had heard of before I interviewed there, when I started handing out the cards, you go to New York as a kid, you know, and you're starting out your life and you go out to the bars and you hand out your cards, people would be like, ooh, because the company's name was Goldman Sachs.
Oh, geez.
And I'd never really heard of it because I'm the daughter of an aerospace engineer and a special ed teacher in D.C. So we were more like sciencey and we just weren't tuned in.
The financial markets.
Weren't tuned in at all to what was going on in New York because I'm from D.C.
That is fascinating. So you worked with them. So how did you get segue from Goldman Sachs to out here to...
Well, they have a name for people like me. They call us shadow artists. It's a great book called The Artist's Way. But basically, I brought my friend, my friend's paintings to New York. They were rolled up under my bed. And I didn't realize when I took the job that it was pretty much 6-7 day a week job for the next 3 years. And I, you know, you get up and go to work at 7 in the morning and you don't come home till 9 or 10 at night. So there wasn't a lot of time for art dealing. I did go around Soho though. And my biggest miss as far as investing in art and collecting is that I really wanted to buy some Warhols. This was in the late 80s. He was still alive, I think. And I didn't have the money.
The wherewithal.
They were $800, which was a lot of money.
Sure.
You know, to buy a Warhol print. They also seemed to be a lot of them around. So I didn't feel that valuable, but they were interesting and it was happening. You know, Keith Haring was painting sides of buildings and it was just kind of interesting to be in New York at that time.
Yeah, it was an interesting time.
But a parallel universe thing, because I was doing the Wall Street thing and that was happening in front of my eyes, but not in my life.
Right. So how did you get, okay, so now you're rising through the ranks of Goldman Sachs. What happened then?
Well, I was an equity research assistant to a couple of senior analysts in equity research. And that's a place where you learn about picking stocks. And you basically do, I did all of the legwork for a semiconductor analyst, a healthcare analyst, and a beverage and tobacco and a specialty retail. So you kind of keep learning. It was very exciting. Every morning you'd hear 10 to 20 case studies, and then an economist would speak. And I was there during my first year on the job was the best of times and the worst of times, because the market kind of shot up 30% in 87 and then it collapsed. And it was a very interesting time to be there. But I always had a milk crate filled with art supplies that I carried everywhere with me. And I even took art classes. I took an art history class at NYU in continuing ed, and I took a studio art class at School of Visual Arts, because it was always there. Mm-hmm. And I spent almost every weekend going to the museums and walking around Soho to see what was happening. So those were the two things I did. I worked a lot and then I did that. And then I moved to Hong Kong in 1989.
And was that because of work or?
I quit my job at Goldman and I flew over there and interviewed for jobs and I got a job. And at the time there were only three of us who were trained New York City analysts with CFAs and, you know, had the training in New York. All of the other stock analysts in Hong Kong at the time were newspaper reporters. Yeah.
newspaper reporters.
They were ex-newspaper reporters who in brokerage firms had hired to write articles about the companies.
I see.
So we were coming out of it from a different thing. And that was my roommate was a guy named David Kowitz. And my boyfriend was a guy named Sheldon Kasowitz. And the punchline of this story is after 4, 5 or 6 years, I always still took watercolor classes. I had my art supplies. I bought a lot of art during my 20s, much more expressionistic than what I show in the gallery. And at the end of 5 or 6 years, I had been in the industry for 8 or 9 years and I needed a break. So I came, and my mom was ill. So I came home for the summer to Shelter Island.
Oh, and then from Shelter Island, you got to Sag Harbor?
My second day on Shelter Island, I ran into a painter named Nelson White, and he's a painter I represent now. And he started teaching me how to paint. And I said to him, I walked up to him on the beach and I said, I've always wanted to know how to paint. And he said he would teach me. So he started teaching me how to paint. And I didn't quit my job because it was so lucrative. You don't mm-hmm. just walk away from those jobs.
Right.
I took a leave of absence, but because I started painting on the beaches on Shelter Island with Nelson White, I ended up calling them in October and telling them I wasn't going to come back. And I started painting full time.
So now you are you still painting now?
You know what? I painted with my artists basically Nelson referred me to a group in Florence, Italy. And that's where I studied again a couple years later. And my absolute, you know, you meet different teachers in your life that affect you for the rest of your life.
Laura, it's been a delight having you here. You have your gallery. It's on Washington Street.
In Sag Harbor,
just off of Main Street. But you must have a website that people can go to just to get more info about you.
It's grenninggallery.com.
Fantastic.
And it's a very big website. And I bought a new website last year instead of a new car. So you have to go visit it.
Absolutely. I'm sure everyone will. Thank you, Laura.
Okay.
This is John Christopher for Real Life. And we'll be right back with my next guest, Jennifer Savnik, the operations manager of Branch Services. today as my guest, I have Jennifer Savnik, the operations manager of Branch Services. Hi, Jennifer. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yeah, you look great, by the way.
Thank you.
So before we talk about Branch Services, Jennifer, can you tell me a little bit about your background and what led you to join Branch Services?
Sure. I started working at Branch Services back in April of 1999.
Okay.
I started as their front desk
receptionist.
You look
like you were born in 1999.
I wish. So 15 years with them. And during that time, I've gained a lot of knowledge about property damage restoration field. And currently, I manage our property restoration division. And that includes, or we offer services in water and fire damage restoration, asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and we also do construction services.
You know, let's talk about mold remediation. Where does mold come from?
Mold is actually everywhere. It's just an organic thing that grows indoors, it grows outdoors, so it's constantly in the environment, in the air. The main thing that, or main ingredient that mold needs to survive is moisture. Moisture and an organic-based host for it. So if it has those two in combination, then
you've got mold.
You've got mold, yeah. So that's pretty much where it comes from. It's all over and depends on the climate and weather and stuff like that.
So I imagine they have more mold in Florida than say up here, right?
Yeah.
Because of the humidity.
You'll see that in really any tropical area, you know, where it's more humid and moist, you're going to see a lot. You get that musty smell and it'll be more just, you know, you'll have more likelihood to have mold.
You know, something that you see on the weather channel is the mold count. They say it's a high mold count. What does that mean?
It just means that on that particular day, the environment, the surrounding environment is probably more humid. So usually after following like a big thunderstorm or something like that, it means that the environment is increased in its moisture. So therefore, there's going to be a higher mold count on that day.
Okay. To do mold remediation, how much training do you need?
There is training offered through an industry standard educating system. It's known as the IICRC. And I actually have what that breakdown is. It's the Institute of Inspection, Cleaning, and Restoration Certification. And what they do
So someone should ask if they they have the certificate or
If they're a certified firm by the IICRC. In New York State, there's no official licensing that a mold remediation company can
obtain. Anybody can say I'm a mold remediator.
Anybody can, really, you know, and it's sad because there are a lot of people out there who hire the wrong contractors and then they end up with the worst case scenario than they had before.
Well, that's like with Sandy. A lot of people in Jersey had people come in saying, yeah, I can get rid of the mold that's taking place. And now it's come back again.
Yep. And what they need to do is there's specific ways where when you remediate a mold situation, you have to kind of contain that area because it is airborne. So if you start disturbing those spores that are already existing in that one area of a home,
they can
easily
else?
Spread someplace else. And if the environment is right and you provide enough moisture for the mold to grow, you're going to have a whole nother problem in another area all over again.
That's very interesting, especially now that you say that. So one of the things a customer should do is make sure that the company that they hire, well, ideally, it would be good if they just hired Branch Services, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But if any company they were looking to have come in is to make sure they're certified.
Yep. And you can go right onto the IICRC website and they have a search that you can plug in any company name. So if you want to cross-reference the company name and plug it into their search database, they'll come up if they're a certified firm with the IICRC.
Fascinating. Are there any signs in a home that can lead a homeowner to suspect that they have mold?
Excess moisture. Usually basements is a big area where you're going to find mold. In attics if they're not vented properly. Same thing with basements. I mean, even just on main floors in homes, if you don't have central air conditioning and you have a back room in a home where it's, you know, you might have a roof leak and it's never drying out, you're going to get a mold problem. So any type of musty smell that doesn't ever go away, you know.
That's a good sign.
It's common to get a musty smell because, you know, things get moist and you can get a little mildew here and there. But if it's something that's constant and it just doesn't go away, you should really have it checked out.
Right. So what are some of the things a homeowner could do to alleviate the possibility of getting mold?
Air conditioning. Oh, you know, during the summer, especially central air is a huge help, or even window units. That's going to help keep the environment dry and cool. They can also just constantly inspect their home and make sure that they don't have roof leaks. Just keep on top of everything and maintenance. And if they see something where they think it might be a problem, address it immediately. Don't let it sit, because what's going to happen is it's going to just grow and grow and grow, and you're going to be faced with a bigger problem in the end.
Now, speaking of mold, is some mold more toxic than other mold?
There is. There's it's black mold, which is, I hope I pronounce this correctly, it's called Sacubatrus. And people who have a tendency to be sensitive to molds are extremely sensitive to this one type of mold. And it can affect your respiratory system. It can, you know, give you headaches. It can cause a lot of problems for somebody who's already predisposed and very sensitive to mold itself. So, yeah, that's it. I mean, there's green mold, there's black mold. The best way to figure out what type of mold you're dealing with is to have it tested ultimately. Mm-hmm. And have it removed the right way. No, we do not do testing. We feel that it's a conflict of interest mm-hmm. to test and remediate. So if someone was to call us and they were looking for testing, we could definitely recommend companies
somebody.
To them. Yep.
Oh, great. Now, you also do air duct cleaning. Can mold lurk in the air ducts?
Yes, air ducts, because they'll contain moisture. And so, again, you wouldn't think mold needs a organic surface to grow on. So it's not common for mold to grow on cement or metal or anything like that, but it will grow on the dust.
Now, once you've gone in and you've remediated the mold, do you offer any type of guarantee that it won't come back?
We cannot, just because mold is always naturally occurring in the environment. So we could remediate a project and it could be great and good to go and dried out and all new sheetrock put up. But if that particular homeowner happens to have another water damage, or if there's another situation where there's excess moisture in the household and in the environment, mold is going to grow again. You know,
right.
We can guarantee that we're going to use it in with the direct guidelines provided by the IICRC, but it's really, really difficult to guarantee it.
Right. That's not coming back, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you have, if you alleviate the problem with, say, a dripping pipe or something like that, then
yeah,
theoretically shouldn't come back. Speaking of pipes, dripping pipes, what happens if a pipe burst or you get a deluge of rain? How do you guys take care of water damage? That's one of the other things that you offer.
Yes, that would be considered an emergency service. So with a situation like that, we would dispatch a crew immediately to the home. Usually in a situation like that, hopefully the homeowner has already contacted their plumber to stop whatever that plumbing leak was. And then we would go in, we would assess the situation, and then we utilize dehumidifiers, high velocity blowers. We also use antimicrobial sprays, which are organic and they're environmentally friendly. And if any contents need to be moved or switched around, they would be removed from the premises and just dried out and taken care of the right way.
Fantastic. Well, Jennifer, it's really been great having you here. I suspect that you also have a website that if people wanted to find out about Branch Services, they could go to the website.
Yes, we can. It's www.branchservicesinc.com.
Fantastic. Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time to come today. This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back with my next guest, Richard Taverna, who is the real estate photographer and videographer. Hi, this is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I have as my guest real estate photographer and videographer, Richard Taverna. Hey, Richard, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Good, you look great, Richard. Before we get into what you're doing with photography and video when it comes to real estate, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a really small town in upstate New York, about an hour northwest of Syracuse. So it was very rural.
What was the name of the town?
Floyd.
Floyd.
Between Rome and Utica. So
wow.
In
Never
the country.
Heard of it.
Cows were my neighbors, you know, yeah. You had to wait for them to cross the street.
So when you were a kid going to school, right?
Yeah.
You saw a lot of cows?
I literally, when I started driving, had to wait for them to cross. So we're talking rural. Yeah.
That sounds like, yeah, but it sounds idyllic. Was it idyllic or?
It was a perfect place to grow up.
Right.
I appreciated it back in the 1970s. It was simpler then. You could kind of, kids were allowed to do a lot more than they are today. So it was a great place to grow up.
Right. How many kids do you think were in your graduating class?
Less than 300.
Wow. So it wasn't a large school at the time.
No. Wow.
That's amazing because nowadays the schools have, well, I think Pearson's probably on that same level, but in Sag Harbor. But anyway, now there's a statistic that says that 80% of people never move more than 25 miles from where they were born. And you ended up here out in the Hamptons. So, and you were someplace before that, obviously. So what was the impetus to leave Floyd?
Well, I mean, I already said it. It's a very small town. And I had I had always had a fascination with New York City growing up, even as long as I can remember. So that was kind of my goal. And as I got older in high school, it just became a real goal to end up there. So I finally ended up there at FIT in my senior year, studying advertising design.
So you were design, what type of design?
I was studying advertising.
Oh.
So, you know, ad layouts, that kind of thing. Right. Brochures. That's what I ended up doing for many years in New York.
Now, did you ever work for an ad agency or?
Just small studio, you know, studios more than that. I never worked for big agencies. That really wasn't my cup of tea.
Right. Did you have any mentors along the way?
You know, I think my biggest mentors were probably my parents, just teaching me how to be a good person. And then after that, I would say, you know, my art, I was lucky to have really good teachers throughout all my schooling that encouraged my artwork and to pursue that.
So, and is that from the painting aspect or,
you know what, it
drawing?
Was, I was surprisingly enough, my high school offered photography, printmaking, sculpture, you name it. We had a dark room. So we were lucky to have that. It was very artistic driven. So I learned a lot there. And then when I went, you know, my professors in college, a lot of them were fine artists themselves. So I learned a lot from them, just, you know, to how to hone your eye, how you look at the world even.
Yeah. So, well, it shows in the work that you do, especially the videos that you do for real estate. Now, you're actually more involved doing stills, and a lot of agents still haven't broached the field of video yet for their listings. Why do you think that's so?
I think people have gotten hung up with what a video tour was. You know, those traditional 4 or 5 minute tours where it shows you every nook and cranny of the house, where I appreciate doing something shorter, more of an ad for the house, you know, like a quick look into the property as opposed to, because you show them too much and then they're going to find things they don't like. Whereas you just show them enough to entice them.
That's the customers we're talking about.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you want to entice them to come out, because a lot of times, even before they get to work with agents, you know, the photography is the first thing they see.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, people I think would spend a minute, maybe a minute and a half too. Yeah. To watch, you know, if you keep it interesting for them.
Right. And I think you do a great job with
Thank you.
So that's one of the reasons I have you on here, because I think that what you do is very artistic. Speaking of which, doing what you do all the aspects from the music to the editing to the shooting. Do you ever think about that you might want to expand your artistic wing, so to speak, and do a film?
That's interesting. You know, taking the leap from still to the video, I was nervous about the editing process and how that might be overwhelming to me. But I found actually that's something I really enjoy doing, and going through the footage. It was all just a matter of like the unknown. You know, you take a still photo, you know what you're doing. But all of a sudden I couldn't really grasp the idea of film until I actually started doing it. So maybe it's a possibility. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever had a challenging shoot?
Yes, I've had a few. I mean, I think they're all a challenge because you know, you're walking into the unknown. So somebody told me once, a photographer told me once, you should treat every shoot as a puzzle. So you're walking in and you kind of put it together in your head first, how to approach it, how to go through the process, and then hopefully all the pieces fall into place in the end.
Now, a lot of times on doing the stills, do you stage the shot?
I will stage stuff if it's requested, lightly stage, you know, flowers, plants.
Right, right.
I find I spend most of my time taking away things.
Right. Because people have all their pictures up. They have clutter, so to speak.
I think, you know, prospective buyers or renters want to see, be able to visualize themselves living there, but they don't want it to look lived in.
So what do you have any tips to offer to a broker or a client to help them to get their house prepared for a shoot?
Yeah, I would just say less is more. Take away a lot of the personal stuff that, you know, you use on a daily basis.
Right,
you know, that
kitchens,
kind of,
I know.
Kitchens, like, declutter. I mean, they have, just declutter.
Take the toaster off the...
take some furniture out if you have to.
So in other words, open it up so it looks, that makes
so
sense.
People can visualize their own stuff in there too.
So that's very fascinating. So you're moved into video. How can someone reach you?
I have a website. They can also view my portfolio there. It's refoto.zenfolio.com.
Do you have a phone number they can reach you also?
Sure. It's 917-497-1459.
Fantastic.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life with John Christopher is also brought to you in part by Quantic Bank's lending division that services all of Long Island, Connecticut, and New Jersey. The bank's loan program and services are customized to the individual borrower, including residential, commercial, reverse mortgages, and their community development light doc loan program. More information at Quantic Bank's lending division. Toll free, 888-954-7463, NMLS 403-503, Equal Housing Lender.